From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made at a truck stop on an interstate highway, often bustling with activity for many years, a popular truck stop for, well, truck drivers who need a break or a bite to eat or a cup of coffee. But on this particular afternoon, the truck stop is almost empty. What's going on? Well, if you listen to people like Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang, the age of automation has come, even to the truck stops. For years, we've heard debates about the impacts of automation on various industries, and most often we're talking about manufacturing. Sometimes we discuss fast food and restaurants. But Yang is basing his presidential campaign on a warning. He says we are not thinking big enough, and we're not seeing the full picture of what automation is about to do to this country. Well, maybe you respond, but the unemployment rate is low. Yang points out this is only because the labor force participation rate is the lowest it's been in decades, around 62%, and as he points out, roughly the same rate as places like El Salvador and the Dominican Republic. But maybe people can move to find jobs, you might say. But the rate of interstate moving is also lower than it's been in decades in this country. That paints a stark picture. Jobs are leaving many areas, but people are staying, either because they want to believe the jobs can come back, they believe the promises of politicians, or because they can't afford to move. Andrew Yang is calling for a UBI, a universal basic income. The federal government, in his proposal, would provide $1,000 per month to all citizens once they turn 18 years old. Yang says that's not enough for people to thrive, live lavishly, but it's enough to be a safety net. It can be enough to help someone move. It can be enough to help someone start a new business or work on a new idea. And he says the age of automation demands it. So back to that truck stop. Where are the truckers? Yang points out that automation will change trucking too, and there are models for this. Companies working on plans in some cases to have, say, one human truck driver with two trucks following behind run essentially by automation. There are 3.5 million truck drivers in this country. How many could lose their jobs to that kind of automation? Half? More? A very small amount of truck drivers have unionized, and they won't have much power to stop this if it happens. That means fewer trucking jobs, fewer retail jobs to serve those truck drivers, a cascade effect. This hour, a conversation about UBI, how it would work, and whether automation really is pushing us into new and dangerous territory. Let's welcome our guests for the hour. The policy director at the Children's Agenda is Pete Nabosny. Pete, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Patrick Coyle, a graduate assistant at SUNY Brockport and a frequent thorn in the side to some of his political foils. Nice to have you.
That's an interesting intro, but I'll take it. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you back here. Tim Bidek is a screenwriter and a director who's researched UBI, has a lot to say on this. It's nice to have you in studio. Thank you, Tim.
Oh, great to be here, Evan.
And Pastor Matthew Martin Nikoloff is pastor of the South Wedge Mission. That's a church that does a lot of work to lift up all people in our community, and we thought it'd be interesting to get sort of that perspective. Nice to have you back here.
Thanks.
So, before we dive into what our guests have to say, let's listen to a little bit of what Andrew Yang had to say. This is not an hour on Andrew Yang. It's more about UBI, the conditions that might or might not call for it, and the various proposals. His is just one. But when it comes to some of the rebuttal that there is, well, here's what happens here. He wanted to do two things with the comment you're about to hear. He wanted to address the idea that while automation is happening, well, it's only going to impact some fields. He contends we're not grappling with just how broadly automation is hitting like a wave across many fields. But he opens the clip by responding to some of the critics of UBI who like to say, hey, that's what they said the Industrial Revolution. You know, all the jobs are going to be gone, automation. You know, the horse and buggy industry was worried about the car. Well, they changed jobs. He says that's, well, lazy. Let's listen to what he has to say.
I find this line of reasoning just so lazy and ridiculous and frustrating, where otherwise educated people will actually cite the Industrial Revolution and say, but look, 120 years ago, we went through something similar and things were like that's actually the argument. But saying that there will always be jobs as long as there are needs fails to take into account how the market values human labor. You can have a radiologist who spent a dozen years in education, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of training, spent 10 years becoming excellent at detecting tumors on films. And then tomorrow, or literally right now, a computer is going to be a lot better at that than that radiologist because it can see shades of gray that the human eye can't detect, and it can reference millions of films instead of hundreds or thousands. So the crudeness of the market as an effective allocator of value to our time is about to be exposed to people. And so we have to evolve to the next form of capitalism as quickly as possible, or else we're going to find ourselves in almost unimaginable circumstances very, very soon.
That's Andrew Yang. So before we get to the specific proposals, UBI or not, I want to ask our guests if they agree with that basic premise, that he sees an urgency that a lot of others aren't quite yet talking with. Pete Nabosny, I'll start with you. How do you feel about that?
I think we have a real urgency in a lot of areas, and I think something like UBI can help address those things. I personally come at it a lot more from an interest in eliminating poverty than I do grappling with some of the impacts of automation. But it certainly, I think, automation is increasing. It's something we need to be thinking about, and I think approaches like this can help mitigate some of the impact of that in the long run.
Okay, Tim Beidick.
I like the idea that, I mean, if you go into a Home Depot today, you see that there's places to cash out without a cashier. So that would mean that that's already happening. And I think Yang points that out a lot, that basically he's got a lot of friends in Silicon Valley. He brings them up all the time, and they're inventing these things. He has a woman he knows. I haven't read his whole book, but his book is The War on Normal People. And it talks to his friends who are creating, basically AI to speak as customer service reps. So it's not like a bot that a bot is speaking. It's like you're going to think in 5 years you're talking to a regular person and it's a computer. So there's so many levels of different things going on. I think that's, it's all new to me. But you can see it around you right now. So I think that's, interesting to keep an eye on already what's going on.
Okay, Patrick Coyle.
I'm ambivalent on UBI as a concept. I think it's a good goal, but I question whether it's feasible and or the most pressing need. But I think that's inarguable. That social mobility is at its lowest point in I think two or three generations. It's incredibly difficult for people to escape the circumstance of their birth, and that does seem to be a flaw in the economic system for me. And I'm not sure how we should change that. But yes, like his larger point about the economy is changing and it's leaving a lot of people who are already disadvantaged behind. That's pretty inarguable.
And as someone in your 20s now surveying the workforce, how much are you and sort of your cohort, this generation, thinking about what is not only already changed but about to change, and how mobile you have to be in terms of what you can do to make an income?
Oh, we joke about it all the time. I mean, there's not every single person who I went to college with, none of them have sustainable full-time jobs that pay them a living wage, except my friends who went to nursing school. They're the real smart ones. But there's, and even the ones that make a decent wage, they've got a $12,000 deductible, or they've got, or they're paying, $700 a month in student loans. If you just look at what we're paying in student loans and healthcare costs, 30 years ago, that was enough to buy a house and a decent car and start a family. And it's just, there's a whole new group of financial constraints that just did not really exist to people who came of age 20, 30 years ago. And I don't think they've realized how fast the world has changed for us.
Okay. Pastor Matthew Martin-Nicola.
I think one of the things that intrigues me about the way that Andrew Yang talks about these things is through his campaign slogan, which is humanity first. I think it's actually okay to look back to the Industrial Revolution to see folks like the Luddites, who weren't just anti-machine going around smashing things, but they were really concerned about the propensity of machines to replace irreplaceable craftsmanship, to degrade the quality of the materials and the goods that were being produced, and actually lowering society's quality of life. In the late 1800s, the Roman Catholic Church, of all people, was one of the most ardent proponents of human dignity in the face of rapid industrialization. And then later, Dorothy Day of the Catholic Worker Movement, of those who were the most left behind by that process. And for the last 50, 60 years, writers, agrarian writers in particular, like Wendell Berry, have been shouting with their poetry and their wonderful writings and their novels to try to see, look what happens when we ignore locality for the sake of bigness, when we shift the focus away from the soil of this place and what can actually happen here and what are the limits of what we can do here, versus just always worshiping kind of this this carrot of progress and bigger is better and experts somewhere else know more than the person who's tilled that soil their whole life. So there's people, spiritual people, I'm sure there's lots of non-spiritual people, Marxists and other kinds of folks who've been critiquing capitalism left and right, trying to help us to see. And one of the things that I think is promising about the conversation that Andrew Yang is hopefully going to introduce to us is what is the human cost? And how do we go to measuring the worth? Do we want a country based on the worth of our goods and of our wealth, or on the wellness of our fellow human beings and the dignity that we uphold in them by the kinds of policies we create? Will UBI do that? I honestly don't know enough about economics other than what I've heard from Andrew Yang say about this issue. I do know that they measure one of the things he's called for, right, is to stop using GDP and to start using metrics of human wellness to measure the quality of life. So instead of saying, look at how the GDP, which really only refers to about the top 20% of our country's wealth, is like, look how great we're doing, which is what the current president likes to do. What about the wellness of our citizens, which is something that, you know, to sound like the crazy leftist, like the Scandinavian countries do, but, you know.
No, they do, right?
They measure in wellness.
I think it's valuable, and I do agree that if you listen to interviews with someone like Andrew Yang, or many of sort of either his acolytes or colleagues who agree, it's to point out that we are a little narrow with the metrics we're using. Oh, well, the Dow's up. Okay. All right. You know, look at the unemployment rate. I mean, I think he very effectively redirects us to labor force participation rates and what it means when people are not participating either by choice or for other reasons. So let's listen to one more clip here. This comes from Congressman Joe Morelli, who was on this program last week and had a chance to ask him directly what he thinks, because now we've got a chance to kind of talk a little bit more specifically. Okay, Andrew Yang says $1,000 a month for life starting at age 18, but there's other ideas out there, and frankly, there have been other ideas tried elsewhere, as Pete's talked about on this program. Here is the conversation with Congressman Morelli. Do you support a universal basic income of any kind?
No, or I would say not yet. I think there are a number of experiments that are going on. I see, unfortunately, in Canada, I guess they've pulled up roots on a project that they were doing. There's other countries that have done it. I haven't seen the results of any of it. I think it's complicated, and I do think we're coming up on a dramatic change in society unlike anything we've ever seen. It's not the shift from agricultural to industrial revolution, industrial to – this is a seismic shift in all this. So we have to rethink everything we do. So, but I just haven't seen UBI done in a way that gives me comfort that we're ready for it yet.
Okay, so he says we're entering a dramatic shift unlike anything that society has ever seen, but he's not supporting any specific ideas on that yet. So Pete Nabosny, he referenced Canada, and there are, as you mentioned in an email prior to the show, some greatest hits that people refer to, but let's kind of just briefly kind of go into some of that. What have we seen, and how much data do you think is out there about whether UBI works?
Sure. So there's a fair bit. I mean, at different times. And I think there was a movement in the 70s around something called a negative income tax, which is different than a UBI, but I think captures some similar thinking around we need to set a floor in terms of what everyone in a community or everyone in a country receives for income. And that was the experiment that was done in Manitoba, Canada in the 70s, in a really small farming community in Canada. And it went on for a couple of years, and they ensured that, I forget the exact dollar amount, but everyone had a pretty good standard of living there. And it went on for a couple of years before governments changed, and then they pulled the plug on the program. And they look back years later, this was in the mid-70s, they look back in the 80s at a lot of things around labor force participation, public health records, things like that. And they found some really, I think, positive results. They look. Mental health concerns among residents of that community dropped dramatically. Hospitalizations for psychiatric hospitalizations fell quite a bit. They did look at things like, and I think this is one of these challenges when we're talking about something like universal basic income. You know, what's our goal around it? Is the goal to, because I think a lot of what people talk about is, does it reduce workforce participation? And in that area, it did. It workforce participation went down a bit. Now, again, this is a negative income tax, which we can talk about, but it went down among high school students who were previously leaving the workforce to go work in farms. So, you know, I'd say finishing your high school diploma was probably
they weren't
a good
leaving.
Thing.
You mean they were leaving school to go
they
work
were leaving,
in farms?
Yeah, prior to the introduction of this program.
Yeah.
They were leaving school to, you know, work, you know, in the labor market. And, you know, I think it's a good thing when someone graduates high school. So I think I don't view that as a negative. But some people took a look at the high level results and said, well, we lost labor force participation. Other people who didn't return to the labor force as quickly were new mothers. So you had people staying out of the workforce for a longer period of time to care for their children, which, you know, is, again, something I personally favor. I think it's great that we now have paid family leave in New York State. And I think we need to expand those kinds of programs. So on both ends, just to pick on that specific example, you did see some things that different people from different perspectives can grab onto. I would argue that that was a success, that you had you know, better mental health among the people in that community, fewer health concerns, and you had in the long scheme of things, you know, better conditions for people, greater well-being in terms of higher high school completion rates and more time for parent-child bonding and attachment in the early years of an infant's life. So I'd say that's a plus. And there's some other examples we can talk about too, but I think that's one of the kind of long-running, really positive ones that we've seen.
But let me follow up with you and then with all of the panel on an issue that always comes up. And most recently, when I saw the various interviews that Yang has been doing, and I'm not picking on any one particular station, but this came up in multiple ways in a Fox News interview in which some of the hosts were saying to him, you're going to give people $1,000 a month and they just do whatever they want with it? Like, well, what if they spend it on, you know, XYZ that we think is bad? You know, like, and they were asking him, well, should we stop at some point if it turns out they're spending their money, they're just blowing it on things that we think are, what if they're gambling it? What if they're spending it on alcohol? What if they're, you know, and he pushed back. He goes back to something that Pastor Nikolov talked about, which was the dignity of allowing people to have that autonomy and to not police it. But this is something I think, Pete, that if we ever got really serious as a country about UBI, that there is probably a cultural barrier or at least a national conversation, because there are a lot of people who felt that way, not just the hosts on Fox News. They go, well, you can't just give people money. So two things. On the dignity side, how do you feel about just giving people money to do with what they decide to do with it? And number two, Canada is not the only place that's tried that. There's been tried it elsewhere. Well, generally, what kind of results do we see?
Yeah, so I'd say giving people the material support so that they can live a life that allows them greater dignity is an accomplishment itself. And so, you know, there is also, I think, a lot of talk around dignity of work and all that. And, you know, I believe in that. And I think, you know, I certainly take some satisfaction, quite a bit of satisfaction in the work that I do. And I think most of the folks would agree. But this, we have this incredible paternalism around poor people in this country. And the idea that people who are struggling to make ends meet financially can't handle some of the decisions they need to make in their life, just it isn't grounded in the data. It's grounded in a lot of prejudice. It's grounded in a lot of paternalism. Poor people make bad decisions. Wealthy people make a lot of bad decisions. The difference is when you have a lot of resources, you have a little more wiggle room. You know, if something happens in your life, you have the ability to fall back on you know, your family, your connections that you may have, other supports that exist in your life. When you're a low-income person who's really struggling, you make one mistake and you fall off, you know, a cliff in terms of your stability. And that's something that these programs help support people out of, you know, so that one mistake, one accident that happens in your life doesn't ruin you financially. And I think we've gotten in this really bad place with a lot of our public assistance programs in this country. And that's where I come to a lot of this with, we've set up these systems to, you know, if someone's receiving food stamps, then they can only, you know, buy certain types of food and not other things. And, well, they need diapers, well, too bad. Or if they, you know, need just to take care of some basic household needs, like toilet paper thing, well, it doesn't cover that. You don't have any ability to buy those things. And we just need to take a step back and think about how we're supporting those folks who are struggling financially. And I think a lot of that comes down to trusting people to make the right decisions for themselves and their families, which is borne out by the data in many different places around the world and the U.S. here.
So it's not just philosophy. There's data that underpins it.
That's sure. That's been one of the – there's so much data that suggests that the most successful form of charity in, like, pockets of Africa that are, like, truly, like, the deeply impoverished, just giving people money. Like, it's direct giving, right? Yeah. It's an incredibly successful charitable organization. Their whole thing is they just go into these communities and they just hand people cash. But, you know, like – I just don't, you know, and this is not a good thing, but I just, politically, that's very tough just because a lot of people just don't like poor people.
Well, no, okay, hold on. Back it up. Because I suspect that those who oppose direct financial assistance, just form of giving cash to people, whether it's UBI or some other construction, would disagree that they dislike poor people.
Well, they would disagree. They're wrong.
What do you think motivates people to want to police how that money is spent?
Because there's this belief that, like, if you're in this situation where you need financial assistance, and it's not because of structural barriers that exist from you reaching prosperity, it's because of individual bad decisions that you, the person, made. And, like, you know, a lot of people, the only bad decision they made was being born in a zip code that's, you know, one of the poorest in the country, you know? And so there's all these things, like, you know, we have to make sure that, you know, if we're going to help you, that you're going to be on a good path to do. And it's like, or we could just help people and help, you know, provide them a baseline level of human dignity and not worry about like whether they're doing it the right way or living a life in the way that, you know, a bureaucratic agency wants them to do. Like WIC in particular. I mean, you know, the amount of bureaucratic hoops you have to jump through to get WIC, you know, with literally if you pick up, you know, like a bottle of formula, it's the wrong size, you know, like it's stipulated what you can buy down to the ounces of the product you're buying. And you know, these are truly like impoverished mothers with young children who are making, you know, a lot of whom don't have fantastic English skills, who are making jump through these incredible bureaucratic hoops just to provide for their children. And you know, not only is it, you know, immoral, it's an incredible, it's really expensive, you know, to go through all the, you know, it, from an administrative perspective, and all to make sure that, you know, they're living the life we think is
so might actually be even more inefficient financially.
Yeah, I think we have to remind ourselves what money is. Money is this portable power, and you give it to different people. It circulates throughout the economy, so it goes from one pocket to the next pocket to the next pocket. So if you look at everything as either good, neutral, or bad, most things are good or neutral. So say somebody does buy drugs with it, or they give money to their lawyer to shut up some woman who they had an affair with or something bad, you know, so you buy drugs with it. Well, the drug dealer might go and buy a sandwich. Now it's getting better. And the sandwich guy might go take a yoga class at Flower City Yoga in Irondequoit, or give it to WXXI or their church or something. So soon enough, money is going to be spent good or neutral. So you really, I don't think you should even think about what someone else is going to do with their money, because if you own a business in a local area and there's more money in your area, that money's going to make its way to you. You really, if the accountant at Wegmans, he's not asking, like, where did this guy get his money who bought the apples? He just wants him to buy the apples. So really, I just think we need to rethink almost how we think about money, and just, we'd rather spend, it seems like as a society, we want to spend more money just to avoid giving people money. And so, like, we'd rather have a program that's more expensive than giving money directly to people.
So, Tim, you want to see money not stagnate. You want to see money flowing more freely through communities.
Exactly. That's what I think the only mistake a rich economy can do like ours is not circulate money. If it gets stagnant, I think of it like you have a pool filter for your pool. If you don't turn it on for a few days, it gets real stale. Well, that's what's happening to a lot of small towns and communities, because they don't have Silicon Valley there. All the jobs are, Andrew Yang talks a lot about, obviously, Amazon sucking up $20 billion a year in commerce. Well, Jeff Bezos isn't coming to Rochester to spend his money, but a lot of people in Rochester's money is going to him. So if you circulate that money more, then that's just better for every business. Because I always think, when people are, you know, jobs are obviously a really important thing politically, but if you're raising venture capital, nobody's asking you how many workers you're going to hire. They just want to know how many customers you have. So if you have more customers, that's going to lead to more jobs. And there's actually was a study on the Alaska dividend, because we'll probably get to that, but there's a dividend in Alaska from oil revenue where they give every citizen in Alaska between $1,000 and $2,000 every year. If you live in Alaska, you get that money, just like Andrew Yang would want to do with he calls it the tech check.
I think he calls it now the freedom dividend.
Freedom dividend. And he's like, and he thinks, like, you know, Alaska's doing it with oil. We can do it with technology. We can do a value-added tax on technology, and that can go to everybody. And I think that just means now there's more jobs. And that's what they studied in Alaska. And they said, yeah, that's exactly what happened, is people spent it in their local communities. That was more demand. The demand created then more employment.
Okay, Pastor Nikoloff, when it comes to the way we think about how we want other people to spend their money, you know, judgment is a little bit of the work that you do, is understanding why people judge or think of the way they do about each other. Does it make you uncomfortable, or do you think there's something to be said for saying, okay, if the government's going to give you money, UBI or otherwise, we've got to know how you're spending it?
The government should know how they're spending it?
Yeah.
I think one of the, this will sound like a political dodge, it sort of is, but it's not. it raises the questions of how we value human beings in the first place and what we value about them. Ironically, in a supposedly Protestant, largely Protestant country, we've forgotten kind of the lesson of the Reformation, which was one of my forefathers, Martin Luther, saying that we're not valued because of what we do, but because of who we are. And our good works are not what make us valuable, but who we are makes us valuable, and therefore we would love to do good works. The government has no job being a pastor or a theologian. It's the government. It's a common good organization. But it's largely run by people, including people of no faith, but who are shaped by the American religion, which is that you are what you own. You are what you do. You are what you merit. And even though we like the idea of giving away some of our excess merit to people when it fits us, it's still and this is part of it being a capitalist nation as well. It's entirely oriented towards what benefits you and what matters to you. And everything else is kind of a nice charity act that you do out of your abundance, right? So I think even Andrew Yang's proposals raise some really hard questions. Not just we shouldn't be asking what other people are going to do with the money. We should be asking ourselves, like, how are we valuing those people? If we believe in a human-centered capitalism, what do we think about human beings? And what do we value about them that makes it worth putting them at the center rather than our own profit? I would argue, as someone who believes that a missing component of all these conversations is the spiritual component, and I'm not saying religious specifically, I'm not saying everyone has to be a Christian or a religious believer or a theist, but I would question whether we can have a human-centered capitalism without more centered human beings. Who have a practice and have the discipline to actually listen to other human beings and to allow their humanity to come into view before us, to ask ourselves what we would want in their situation rather than just what we would do now that we have the power. Would we be for Andrew Yang's proposal, for example, if he was saying, why don't we first off give $1,000 a month just to people who have a lineage traced back to slavery as a form of reparations? Because in our fair city here in Rochester, where we have a bridge named after Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass, we also have one of the highest wealth disparities and most racially segregated cities and school systems in the country. So what if we'd said, hey, not everyone here needs that $1,000 a month yet, but most of our city is living in poverty, and it's a humanitarian crisis in our schools of how to help our children not fall off the cracks and go into jail. What would it look like to start with doing so justly? And we value about human beings and also value about owning our mistakes, value a more just society and creating different kind of conditions. I think when we ask those kinds of questions, like Andrew Yang is raising and others are doing, it forces us to start asking what we value, why we value it, how we value it, and where that value is coming from.
Yeah, actually, the second biggest thing he talks about is changing GDP. He always says, if I'm president, the first thing I do is walk down the street to the Bureau of Labor and Statistics and say, we need to change GDP. It's an antiquated system. It never was supposed to measure human good. It's just measuring economic activity. So why don't we have, how are we caring for our elderly? How are we caring for the children? Things like that, that you actually measure. And then he says, every State of the Union, I would just say how we're doing. You know, you can't get somewhere if you don't know what you're going after.
And I would say that one of the biggest threats of having the religious right and far-right Christianity continuing to assert power in our country is not just Donald Trump, but the idea of late-stage capitalism, which can only seek to consume and to increase wealth in the hands of some, syncretizing Christianity into its fold. And then the people who are winning are, I would say, are not Orthodox Christians in any right. They are capitalists who have co-opted Christianity in a form of Christianity that is largely, you know, moved beyond in the Reformation, even within the Catholic Church. And so I do think that the theological nature of Protestant culture in this country and of capitalism is actually at play here, because who runs the country? A lot of people who believe in this prosperity gospel, which is a nice promise you toss out to people. You say, look at Donald Trump. He's prosperous, quote unquote. So he must be the right kind of guy for us to run this country, and he's going to do X, Y, and Z for us. And people buy that stuff. But here comes Andrew Yang saying, actually, that's the opioid of the people right there. The opioid we're feeding you is this reality show, this WWE presidency, where this guy doesn't give a thing about you. But right. But and I think one of the hopes that Andrew Yang has is to say, like, let's all wake up together and start saying that we have dignity. We are co-owners and we are co-investors in this American experiment. It doesn't belong just to 20% of people. And regardless of our vision of the common good or of where we're coming from religiously or socially or class-wise or race-wise, we need to start having those hard conversations about how we value each person in our society at the local level.
Well, I would ask listeners if they want to call the program. I have so many emails already.
Oh, no.
That's a good thing. We could do this all day because there's a lot of interest and there's a lot of very good, pointed, specific questions. You know, for example, Amanda sends a note saying, yes to the pastor, yes, 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 means test this, but do a UBI. Well, the question of means testing
means tested and universal are mutually exclusive.
Well, I think what she's saying is she likes the idea, yeah, but she wants it to be means tested. And that, of course, would, if UBI got to be a serious policy proposal on the national level, means testing would be a question. We'll get to that in our second half hour. We'll get more of your feedback. And after our only break, I will ask all of our participants in this panel today, to tell us if there's any specific one proposal they do like above others. You know, whether it's Yang's proposal, whether it's a different kind of UBI, whether it's a child allowance, something else that they think is most effective at dealing with the problems that we face right now. Our guests in studio include Pete Nabosny, policy director at the Children's Agenda. Tim Bidek is a screenwriter and director. Patrick Coyle, a graduate assistant at SUNY Brockport. And Tim and Patrick have been particularly active in researching and thinking about these issues. Pastor Matthew Martin Nikoloff from the South Wedge Mission. Your feedback and their thoughts on what they like and don't like next. Coming up in our second hour, we preview a historic production of the August Wilson play Fences. It's happening in Rochester. It is the first ever deaf black production of Fences, and it will be accessible to both deaf and hearing audiences. And we will stream the video next hour so you can view and read on the conversation next hour on our Facebook page for WXXI News. Join us next hour. Welcome back to Connections. Let's ask our participants directly if there's any single proposal, either on UBI, related or otherwise, that stands out to address these issues that you would support right now. You heard Congressman Morelli earlier this hour say there's nothing right now that he's comfortable with. Pete Nabosny, is there something that you are comfortable with?
Yeah, so I don't want to draw the ire of the Yang Gang too strongly here, but I do think there are some kind of flaws.
They call themselves the Yang Gang, and yeah. By the way, they probably love the fact that this conversation's happening.
Sure.
It's a good for them and for Andrew and for the country. It's good. Go ahead.
Sure. So I think there are a couple of flaws in what he's put forward specifically. One, the most kind of glaring thing to me is it's $1,000 a month for every adult, yeah. And the group in society, the age group in society most likely to be in poverty is children, and it's particularly young children. It's children under five, and this proposal doesn't account for the fact that if you're a parent, if you have young children, that is a considerable added cost, and you know you can't put your 6-year-old out to work, and so not accounting for family size and the occurrence of children as one of the factors in this kind of thing, I think, is a real miss. The Alaska dividend, it is awarded to families with children. That child receives the dividend as well, and so I think that's a miss. I'm a little concerned around some of the language for low-income individuals who are receiving public assistance. They would be able to kind of choose whether they're receiving the dividend or continue to receive some of the benefits that they are previously been getting. And the kind of real-world effect of that is that it kind of distributes more assistance to folks further up the income chain. If you were receiving food stamps and Medicaid or getting housing assistance, things like that, the kind of cash effect of that, it could be greater. But So specifically, the proposal that what I'd like to see, seeing how far away we are from some kind of universal benefit program in this country, and we don't really have much cash assistance. I think a great place to start would be with something like a child allowance that you alluded to. There was a recent report put out by the National Academies in Washington D.C., a bipartisan report that concluded that a child allowance paying a certain amount of money to families with children every year, kind of like a child tax credit but structured a bit differently, would be the most effective way to reduce child poverty in this country.
And again, how does it work?
So there's a couple different proposals out there. I think the way I'd like to see it work would be, you know, if you have young children, the government knows about you having young children. You file for your Social Security. There's tax things, all that kind of stuff. If you have young children, you get a certain amount of money each month to cover some of the expenses associated with having children. And you'd receive it from birth to 18. There may be different levels at different ages, things like that. But that would be universal, or at the very least means tested at the really high end where you know, Jeff Bezos wouldn't get it, but but most middle and even upper middle class families would, because lots of families have a need for supporting some of the costs of having children. And I think that's a good sort of bridge to both target resources towards families most likely to be in poverty, most needing of support. And the research shows that income supports for families with children, it really does end up benefiting those kids in terms of school readiness, in terms of high school graduation, in terms of well-being as adults. So I feel like something that's universal but also targeted to a specific group like children is really the way to go. I could go into other areas. I think we have a lot of really bad policies with disability policies, things like that. But I think, you know, starting with children would be a real good way to go.
A child allowance. Okay. Tim.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I do like that aspect of what you're talking about. I really like that Andrew Yang's been the first person who made me think about having no stigma on it. So if it goes to every adult, even the wealthy, then there's no stigma. That's how they do it in Alaska, and then you can't fight against the poor, like Patrick was talking about. You know, like if someone just thinks the poor are lazy, you can say to them, well, you get it too. So don't worry about them. Just worry about your own friends, your family, and the way you're going to spend it instead of thinking of everybody else. The other thing I think was good about it is it's politically really good because it's simple. It's $1,000 a month. That's really simple politically to get across in a soundbite. And it covers – the only thing I would think about is Elizabeth Warren's talking about a wealth tax. If you took a wealth tax and you combine it with a national dividend and say, look, we're one country, think of it like a company, we're all shareholders, we all get a piece of that wealth. You could take I'm not one to quote Fox News polls, but I saw this come up recently, and it said, what bothers you most when paying taxes? 34% said rich are not paying enough, even on a conservative station, and 28% say the way government spends our taxes. So more than 60% of the poll are saying government should spend it better, and we should take more from the wealthy. So if you took Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax and you gave it directly to people and say, well, now there's no bureaucracy, now there's not a government to screw up spending the money, I think that politically works really well.
Okay, and to Tim's point on Elizabeth Warren's proposals, of all the candidates in the race so far, I would say just from my perusal of it, she's got the most specific policy proposals out there.
By far.
And we're going to be covering those just as we're doing UBI today. This program is going to spend probably comparatively very little time on the horse race and a lot more on policy as we go throughout the next couple of years. Patrick Coyle, so policy proposals you like or don't?
So Matt Brunig over at the People's Policy Project, which is a lefty think tank, has he's got seven policies, and he calls them the Family Fun Pack, and they're all designed to aid people in having children and families and sort of take away the economic penalties that we face for, you know, choosing to have children. And first is, it's a baby box. So like every family just, you know, this is very common in European, especially Scandinavian countries. Families will just get like, you know, a box, all the supplies you'll need for like the first three-ish months of a baby's life just to help them, you know, segue into parenthood. You know, 36 weeks of parental leave, free government-funded childcare, which, you know, would help new parents go back into the workforce, free government-run pre-K, just try to, you know, mitigate the education gap between low and high income kids, universal free school lunch, changing the making kids 0 to 26 eligible for Medicare rather than their parents' insurance, and then a child allowance of $300 a month per child under 18 in the house. And I think those set of policies are all defensible on their own, but together they would really do a good job at, you know, helping people, especially low income people, have kids and still have normal lives. And I think that's got to be an incredibly important goal for any future, you know, person who wants to really be a populist president and, you know, make it easier for people to exist in their lives.
Okay. Pastor Nikoloff.
I like a lot of the things that have been said already, so I won't go over them already. But I do think some of the things I've heard Andrew Yang say, for example, in some interviews with African-American publications, for example, is he vowed, I think it's The Root. I have to make sure I have it right. But he vowed that he would clean up the water in Flint if the state of Michigan wouldn't do that, to rectify that inequality as an emblem of how we're going to move forward from that kind of valuation of people as disposable towards people who are valuable. He's talked about issuing pardons to all nonviolent recreational drug charges to everyone who's in jail that way, to reset that kind of thing. I know people are probably freaking out as I say
but
he's
limited in what he can do because most federal drug, because he can only do federal pardons, and most of the federal drug charges.
But just
are,
even symbolically, I think, you know, the $1,000 a month, especially if it was given to people the country has a history of victimizing or targeting with oppression, would be a great place to start, especially to help give generations a chance to move out of systemic poverty and to try to break the cycle. I like how he says that the money is not the solution, but it tries to lay a foundation for solutions. I would also say that as a church person in particular, I think church denominations and larger churches in particular are huge political organizing bodies in themselves. And I think I would like to challenge all churches not to wait until Andrew Yang becomes president to start thinking about how we we give away wealth. Like, what if churches gave $1,000 a month, especially mega churches where they're making quite a bit of money, gave $100 a month to each of their people and said, how are you going to build up your neighborhood with this money each month? How are we going to, instead of sending money overseas where some of it is eaten up in a nonprofit kind of, you know, a little bit is grifted off here and here and here until it finally gets to Africa, and investing in the neighborhoods right around you. In my crazier ideas, I would say there should be a mega church tax. If your church as a nonprofit is making over X number of dollars, then there should be some sort of common good fund that that tax goes into that would then go back into the community. Because churches benefit from government nonprofit laws and from all sorts of things. So they're escaping responsibility in some ways and then choosing where to send money, often to the pastor's Jordans. It's funny that someone is saying, like the Joker, you give $1,000 to some guy on Hudson and he's just going to buy some Jordans. And it's like, well, yeah, it's bad when that guy does it, but when there's mega church pastors walking around with $4,000 Jordans, it's okay somehow, right? It's not. Like, that money does not belong to us. It belongs to everyone. So I think churches can think more creatively, and religious communities and in spiritual communities and activist communities and any other kinds of community associations. I think that's a big gap in this plan. Like I said, this can help to put a Band-Aid on things and help to slow some of the suffering and create an easier landing for people. But we need to also address some of the spiritual crises, which I think Andrew Yang does bring up a lot. He talks about how he quotes a number of statistics about how when we're out of work, what it does to our IQs, what it does to our productivity, what it does to our mental health, what it does to the rise of the opioid crisis, the idea that suicides have surpassed obesity as a cause of death in this country, the ways that our mental health and our spiritual health and our community health as a nation are just deteriorating. Yeah, and so churches, if you're listening, like, we need to take seriously these things and not just getting people into church so they can give us their tithe check, but trying to mitigate the common good so that less people are in the situation, more people can find the footing to make decisions for themselves.
All right, Tim, you want to jump in?
I was just going to say,
get some phone calls.
Yeah, one thing you think of, just the reduction of crime. Most crime is money crime. And if you're getting, for Andrew Yang, he's saying if you get $1,000 a month and you go to jail, then you're going to lose it. So it's a big incentive. If you just think of incentives, if you're going to go rob a convenience store, but you're going to, if you wait a week, you're going to get another $1,000 check, you're just not going to do that. That would make no sense. So if, just hypothetically, it seems like it would just reduce crime like crazy.
All right, Rick in Bath on the phone. Go ahead, Rick.
Yeah, I have to kind of disagree a little bit on the money thing. When you don't have a lot of money, you got to buy what you need, not what you want. And I think that's sometimes over the years, that's why you see a lot of the restrictions, because people buy what they need, what they want instead of what they need. And I think that's kind of what it is. And I'll tell you one thing. I think the biggest problem with poverty and weight and income, you know, equality is the federal government, they're propping up, like, if the federal government didn't prop up the rents and different other items in the economy, the market would stabilize. Like, say you have an apartment and you ask, it's like $700. Well, you know, people can't pay $700, but the government will cough up half of it. And that artificially is inflating. It's the government is inflating a lot of these prices. And until that comes down, you're not going to see no change.
Can you elaborate on that?
What's that?
Can you elaborate on that? Just the mechanisms in which the government pays half this overinflated rent?
I don't know exactly what the name of it is, but, you know, you have subsidized rent. I mean, I know a lot of people, they have subsidized rent. Well, Section 8, I guess you call it. Section 8. And
yeah,
so,
that's not so what Section 8 is.
So you say you got Section 8 and you got, people that can only afford, like, say, $400 a month for rent, but the landlords are charging $800. And if the government wasn't, you know, divvying up so much on top of that, it would, you know, they would have to bring their prices down, you know, they would have to bring their prices down to get people in. I think I see that in several other areas.
All right, I got to jump in and say that Diana from Pittsburgh writes in to say her biggest concern with this idea is the cost of living would rise in response, because producers will assume people have more money to spend and raise their prices, similar to the concern from Rick and Beth. Is there anything that we feel like support.
Yeah, I think
could we see that happen?
I think a simple example is to say, okay, say you told someone in Compton you're going to give them $1,000 a month, but they have to spend it in Beverly Hills. Would they turn you down? No, but Beverly Hills, you know, purchasing power is way higher than Compton, so prices are higher, but they're not that much higher for to cancel out $1,000 a month for consumer goods. Like, it's just, like, competition kicks in. That's when competition kicks in. Because somebody raises their prices, then somebody else is going to open up a business to compete with that. So it's always a matter of, yeah, it might be the difference between, say, a poorer suburb and a richer suburb. Because that's already what happens in the economy. Is, you know, Eastview Mall is more expensive than things sometimes at Grease Ridge. Just that's just common economics.
Pete Nabosny?
Sure. So, I mean, maybe this is unusual for radio or whatever, but I think one of the
yeah,
things.
Yeah, there's no way to.
We've piloted some of these programs in different places, and one of the challenges with piloting something is you don't know what the economy-wide effect of something is. So, you know, there's a recent pilot in Finland where they gave 2,000 unemployed individuals unconditional cash assistance and kind of tracked what happened. And it had all sorts of positive results, but 2,000 people isn't large enough to see what impact does that have on consumer prices in a region or rents or things like that. So I do think that's why it's tricky to kind of forecast out some of this stuff. But we do have examples of you know, I think – we do have places where we know we've put money into the economy where you know, standards of living have risen and things like rent do go up. But ultimately, you know, low-income folks do end up benefiting from those things. So saying we shouldn't give people some support because there may be some kind of inflationary problem in some areas is, you know, I don't know. It's a really – it's like, so we leave people destitute? You know, like what's the alternative?
If you're just taking the circulation of what already exists out there, that would be a really bad sign for our current economy if the way to keep inflation steady is just to clog it up at the top. And if you start to circulate it to everybody else, now there's going to be inflation. Well, that's a bad – now the whole economic system doesn't make any sense if that's the result.
And Yang kind of talks about more of like this idea of a trickle-up effect, right?
Yeah,
I mean, his hope is that in like poor communities, there's more money to start businesses and then you can keep monies within communities.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that he kind of does though, and I think we should be careful with UBI, is it's kind of like vibranium from Black Panther. It's this mythical substance that can supposedly do everything.
Oh, yeah.
Right. But no one's ever seen it, right? Because it's a comic book. And I think no matter what solutions we come up, and I like this one as like a good start, like there's a whole lot of human effort and a whole lot of community building and a whole lot of other stuff, mentorship, community infrastructure, spiritual infrastructure. There's a lot of work that needs to be done along with this. And I do think that he has other proposals around those lines too, as do other candidates. But I think to say like everyone just gets $1,000 and everything is magically better, like nobody is saying
it's
that.
The magic wand policy.
Yeah, sure.
And it's great that he's not saying that. He says take the boot off of people's necks.
Right.
But then we start to deal with like what's real value? What do we value? He says his wife takes care of their kids. She has no economic value, but clearly she has a lot of value. So we have to start looking at
It's not where we end up, but it's a good place to start.
So Rolf is asking real briefly to the panel, how would we pay for a UBI? I'm going to ask the policy guy, Pete Nabosny, whether it's a child allowance, UBI, how does the government pay for it?
Well, so there's a couple different proposals out there. I mean, I think Andrew Yang's proposed a value-added tax, which is kind of like a sales tax applied to all sort of parts of the supply chain. We probably don't want to go too far into it. You know, I think there's a lot of proposals for how to raise revenue. We are an extremely wealthy country, and there's plenty of ways that, you know, ultimately things get paid for through taxes. And so there's a lot of different tax proposals to support something like this or like a child allowance. But, you know, I think ultimately, you know, some of this comes down to like political will. We're not
sure.
Lacking of resources.
Yeah, and if you think of it almost more like monetary policy and less like government spending, when the Fed raises interest rates or reserve ratios, no one says, what's that going to cost the taxpayers? It's just good economics. So if you look at it in terms of we're going to cut all these costs are going to go down, jails, homelessness, things like that, then it's just a return on investment. You're just looking at it like we circulate more jobs get created. And it would, some people, I mean, some economists have looked at it and said, we'll make money on this. This will make money.
Yeah.
Well, it's less expensive to care for somebody at the beginning and give them a good start than to care for them later on and heal them from the problems that you gave them in the first place, right? And we're not, our government shouldn't operate like the cigarette companies.
Well, Rolf finishes by asking, is it proposed, a UBI proposed as an alternative or in addition to Social Security, Medicare, et cetera, other safety nets? It's not an alternative entirely, no. Those other programs assumedly would still be there, right? And
it depends on the individual implementation. There are ones that say, like, yeah, like, and that's why there are some, like, libertarian conservative cases for a UBI in that, you know, like, the whole hydra of, you know, early childhood programs, SNAP, WIC, you know, like, they... there's administrative and bureaucratic savings that could be realized by just switching entirely to a universe-based income.
So it comes down to proposal. Rolf, thank you. By the way, as we get ready to close, I mean, this has been a really good, interesting policy discussion and a ton of feedback from people who are, I think, hungry for more depth of discussion like this on policy. Are you optimistic we're going to see it in the presidential and upcoming campaigns?
No. I mean, like, as a real thing that, like, a lot of big campaigns get behind? No. I just don't. I think it's too easy to attack it by saying, "Oh, you're going to take the hardworking taxpayer money and give it to, you know, people who don't want to work." I don't think people want to take that risk.
All right, Pete Nabosny, are you getting any more optimistic in working in policy yourself that this is getting a little more sophisticated?
Well, no one was talking about anything like this 5-6 years ago, and I think, you know, the conversation is advancing. I think people are starting to understand how we need to better support folks. But I mean, I'm not a political prognosticator, but I do think the trend is in the right direction. So understanding how we can better support folks in society.
Would you direct anybody anywhere to kind of read more either on child allowance, et cetera?
They can email me, pete@thechildrensagenda.org. I mean, I think Vox has done a lot of good work on it. People's Policy Project.
Yeah, People's
good,
Policy Project has one on a social wealth fund and child allowance.
And Andrew Yang has a CNN town hall actually this Sunday at 8. So it's good if you want to find out more about him.
And what's the name of his book, Tim?
Oh, The War on Normal People.
The War on Normal People. Tim, Patrick, Peter, Pastor Nicola, I've really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you all for being here. We appreciate that. More connections coming up.